Central Time, I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Ethics Commission is tackling the issue of cryptocurrency donations to political candidates using things like Bitcoin. We'll get both sides of that issue in just a bit. First, Governor Walker, as we're hearing in the news, is calling for stricter guidelines to slow the spread of chronic wasting disease, or CWD, in the state. According to the Wisconsin DNR, 53 counties are affected by the disease, which impacts both wild and farmed deer populations. The new rules would regulate the moving of deer between counties, require higher fencing around deer farms, and dictate how deer meat can be harvested and transported in the state. Patrick Durkin is a freelance columnist for 17 Wisconsin papers, including the USA Today Network Wisconsin, the Wisconsin State Journal, and Wisconsin Outdoor News. Patrick, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, what are your thoughts, Patrick, on these new emergency rules proposed by Governor Walker?
It's one of those things where it's a good start, and I was happy to see it. But I guess what concerns me is, the governor's calling it aggressive and balanced as far as its approach. But when I look at it, I guess I have to say that most of it, two of the three things he's mentioning here are affecting only the game farms, deer farms. And the biggest problem where we have the most disease is still out in the wild herds. So it's important to have these rules in place and enforced on the game farms. I think that's very important. But I wish there was more being done to work on the wild deer population.
Yeah, what kind of measures would you like to see when it comes to stopping the spread of CWD, maybe turning the tide on it, if that's possible, in the wild herds?
Yeah, to me, if we were going to say this is really some bold initiatives, we'd be talking more about getting focusing more of the harvest on the antlered bucks, any deer with antlers, basically putting more pressure on that segment of the population, because that's really where the highest number of sick deer, it's occurring more often in male deer by about, not quite 2-to-1, but it's more prevalent in male deer. So I guess I'd like to see more focus on shooting more bucks. But unfortunately, we pretty much shut off the gun hunting for bucks at the end of the 9-day November gun season. That's where it's been a number of years now.
You wrote recently, before these changes were proposed, about the ongoing spread of CWD. Where are we seeing it in the state now? How widespread is it?
Well, right now, like I think you mentioned in the introduction, that we have 53 affected counties. And basically, you break that down and you have 25 counties to actually have a wild, at least one wild deer tested positive in it. You also have 16 counties where they're within like 10 miles of a CWD positive in the wild population. So, 41 of those 53 affected counties are basically in the wild population. And the biggest pocket, the biggest problem area, and it has been this way for, since we got going on this back in 2002, it's basically down in western Dane County, almost all of Iowa County, southwestern Sauk County, and then southeastern Richland County. So you look on the map, and it's just this big blot right there where all these cases are showing up. But just recently, what concerns a lot of us is that they found it really by total luck up in Oneida County and Lincoln County, a case in each county about 2 miles apart from each other. So here you have it up in the Northern Forest now, which has always been the big fear that once it gets into the Northern Forest, well, now you pretty much have a statewide issue.
Founded by luck, you said. How much testing are we doing for CWD?
Really in the big picture, we have not been doing that much over the past decade. My point, I guess, I keep harping on is that I wish we had a rolling system where you may take 5-10 counties every year and do mandatory testing where every deer shot in that county has to be tested. But because right now it's everything in the state right now is voluntary. If you don't want to get your deer tested, you don't get it tested. So like in those four counties I mentioned earlier, Richland, Sauk, Iowa, and Dane, like only 7% of over 30,000 deer are being tested there, each fall, despite, how many cases we have of CWD. So it's really not, I don't think this voluntary approach has really given us a really good look at what's out there.
Talking about chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin deer populations. Patrick Durkin is with us, freelance columnist. He's been covering outdoor and hunting issues for a long time in the state. Governor Walker proposing some new changes in how we deal with CWD. Patrick, let's take a step back, look at the big picture. For people who haven't been following this issue, what are the worries here? What is the damage we're worried about with chronic wasting disease?
Well, eventually it's going to bring, you know, knock this herd down at some point. You know, it hasn't really been a real obvious population decline yet. But, you know, in some of these areas of Iowa County and Richland County, you're seeing over half the adult bucks now are carrying the disease. And when you have, and I think it's like in a 30% range now for female deer, when you start losing female deer to this disease, well, eventually it's going to have a population impact. So that's from a herd perspective, that's a big concern. Another concern, you know, the thing that we always end up talking about as well is a human health concern. Well, right now there is none that we know of. But again, like with almost all diseases, you know, you look at what CWD and you think, well, we've only known about CWD in our country for about, you know, 35, 40 years, which in the lifetime of a disease is not very long. So we really don't know all that much about the disease yet. So I guess my point I always make to people is that the chances of you contracting a disease from CWD is probably pretty minor, but you can't rule it out, so it's still best to play it safe.
And people point towards some states in the western part of the country where they've had CWD, they have detected it longer, and they are seeing those population impacts. They are seeing declining deer populations. Is that right?
Yeah. Wyoming has at least one spot I'm aware of with white-tailed deer, where they've been monitoring it, and they're seeing that happen now, and they're seeing it in some of the mule deer herds too. You're not seeing the older age class bucks. You get these deer, you know, when typically you start seeing the really big mature deer, well, they're not seeing them as much anymore. They're just, you know, they're dying from the disease before they get to be that older age class.
There's been controversy over how we deal with CWD over the years. Patrick, we've talked to you about this before, between kind of a hands-off approach and a more aggressive approach, including eradication or partial eradication in some of the worst affected areas. How have you seen the state's approach change over the, I don't know, what, 15 years since we've been watching this thing, 16 years?
Yeah, we've been kind of riding a roller coaster. You know, we started off real aggressively and those first few years, and you know, the idea that you can ever wipe out a wild deer herd, it's pretty hard. You know, they when they're hunted hard, they get smarter and smarter. The survivors get tougher to find, tougher to shoot. So that was always a pretty aggressive, almost optimistic hope that we'd ever, you know, ever eradicate the herd. That wasn't going to happen. But then I think we backed off, and then we went in the basically a complacent mode. And now we're kind of, I think now we're seeing the tide turn again, where we're realizing this disease is not going away. It is getting worse the way a lot of the wildlife experts predicted it would go. And so now I think we're starting to see people now paying more attention, because you're seeing more voluntary testing. You know, last year I think it increased by almost 3,000, 4,000 deer and got tested last fall, because people are getting worried about it. It's becoming an issue in our households where, you know, wives don't want you bringing home venison if it hasn't been tested. So those kind of factors are happening now. So that's where I've seen it change. But I still think there's other good ideas out there we have not tested yet and we should be talking about. And the one that I keep hoping that at some point we'll get serious about, and this idea of incentivizing deer hunters to focus on certain areas where we have a pretty good understanding of where the most sick deer will be found, and really hitting those areas harder.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
That's Patrick Durkin, freelance columnist covering hunting, outdoors, and conservation issues in Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about Governor Walker's call for new restrictions to slow the spread of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin deer. The Wisconsin Ethics Commission is thinking about whether to allow people to donate digital currencies, things like Bitcoin, to political campaigns. The Libertarian Party of Wisconsin recently asked the commission to provide guidelines for the use of such currency in campaign giving and spending. At a public hearing last week, an ethics panel lawyer said without clear direction, campaigns would be accepting digital contributions at their own risk. He didn't say when the commission would ultimately revisit the issue. Cryptocurrency, as it's also known, refers to online types of money that are not regulated generally by authorities. They allow users to spend money anonymously. That's one of the reasons why the Libertarian Party is hoping to see them be accepted. Phil Anderson is the chairman of the Libertarian Party of Wisconsin and their candidate for governor. Phil, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Jimmy Anderson, no relation, is a Democratic state representative from Fitchburg who has opposed the use of cryptocurrency in political campaigns. Representative Anderson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Phil, let's start with you. Why are you calling for the Ethics Commission to give guidelines and you're hoping to allow Bitcoin and these other digital currencies to be used for political donations?
Well, the reason that we're asking is because Wisconsin currently isn't in line with the federal government in terms of receiving cryptocurrency donations and not even in line with its previous rules. The previous set of rules that govern these sorts of donations included both money but also tangible and intangible assets. That language is no longer in the current set of rules. So we're asking that the state, that the WEC, interpret the current legislation to include that just as a matter of being consistent. But ultimately, it comes down to being a free speech issue. Right now, people can donate money to campaigns. They can donate intangible assets. They can donate real estate, gold, boats, whatever they want to, as long as those donations comply with current finance law. And we're just asking that cryptocurrencies be included in the realm of things that people can contribute and support their candidates.
And Phil, why would somebody want to donate in particular, you know, a Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency as opposed to a check or cash or a gold bullion or whatever?
Well, there are a lot of people who are trying to go away from government-backed money towards cryptocurrencies just by virtue of the fact that the government controls fiat currency. And so in their efforts to express themselves and to change how they do business from day to day, they're adopting cryptocurrencies as their preferred form of currency, as preferred form of money. The current market cap for cryptocurrencies worldwide is over $500 billion and has been as high as $750 billion as recently as January. And as that becomes adopted as a form of currency, it should also be adopted as a way for people to express their speech and support their candidates.
And Representative Jimmy Anderson, you tweeted that permitting digital currency for campaign purposes is, quote, really dangerous for about a dozen reasons, end quote. Can you give us your main case against this idea?
Yeah, I think the big fear has to do with anonymity. You know, being able to use things like virtual private networks or software like Tor would allow people to hide who they are when they're making these donations. So people, say, in foreign countries would be able to make donations to campaigns and be able to hide the fact that they are from a foreign country donating legally and pretending like they're doing so from the United States. I think that the degree of anonymity that comes with using things like cryptocurrency is just a danger to the need for transparency when it comes to campaign finance.
Could the Ethics Committee, Representative Anderson, say you can accept cryptocurrency, but you have to confirm the source? You have to get the provenance of this, get the donor to register that they've donated this to you. Would that clear up that anonymity problem for you?
You know, I don't think so, just because it would become be impossible from my end to be able to determine whether or not the cryptocurrency was coming from a donor in Wisconsin or a donor in Russia. It's just the way that the cryptocurrency works is that it's pseudo-anonymous. So there's only basically like a digital string of letters and numbers to be able to tie the donation from one Bitcoin wallet to another Bitcoin wallet. So there's no guarantee that where the person says the money's coming from is actually where it's coming from.
And Phil, what do you say to that concern over the anonymity of a cryptocurrency donation?
Well, it's already been solved, basically. I've got two responses. First of all, there have been candidates for federal office, presidential candidate for 2016 and other candidates for federal office who have figured out how to document their donations. And, of course, that is incumbent on the candidates to, if they get donations that are anonymous and can't be traced with a name and an address and et cetera, that they have to donate that. So it's already been solved. As a matter of fact, we just set up today an account with BitPay, which is the same online service that Rand Paul used in 2016 and other people have used, that automatically converts the donation to cash as well. So we can monitor exactly where the donations are coming from. If for some reason they're not marked, and Representative Anderson is correct in that there is an anonymity to it, but the same issue exists with people making cash donations, and it's incumbent on the candidates to track that. We've got the technology in place to do that. The federal government already approves of this process, and it's really no more dangerous than accepting cash anonymously. And again, it's incumbent on the candidates to police themselves and for other people to make complaints should they see something wrong going on, but that hasn't really been the case.
And Phil, I guess I'm just thinking out loud here, but could I set myself up as kind of a straw donor and say, yeah, I'm donating to your campaign, I'm putting my name on it, but it's coming from, I don't know, somewhere else in the world via Bitcoin? That would be in some ways easier to pull off than me walking with a bag of cash fronting for somebody else. Would it enable that kind of straw donation?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the straw donations can and do happen in cash. And as a matter of fact, it's a lot easier to track Bitcoin in particular. There have been sites set up and services that are currently used by the FBI that have been tracking down criminals dealing with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies as a way to commit crime. So there is technology that's catching up to it. But I disagree with the notion that it's any easier to do it with Bitcoin. Even if, you know, large cash donations are made at an event and they're split up and claimed anonymously by candidates, that's a lot harder to track actual money changing hands and being deposited than it is Bitcoin, which does come through portals that are, to a certain extent, governed by federal law.
Representative Anderson, if we could do cash, which raises some similar anonymity issues, why not Bitcoin? We're seeing federal candidates, as Phil says, do this already.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a big difference between being able to send a $100 bill, which, you know, being able to get a hold of American currency and being able to deliver it to a candidate is a much different process than, say, if I was interested in avoiding campaign finance limits of, say, $1,000, and I had $10,000 that I wanted to give to a candidate. It's much more easy to be able to create 10 different email addresses, set up 10 different Bitcoin addresses, and then send 1,000 different, send 10 different $1,000 donations using virtual private networks to bounce around from different servers across the United States. It's not that difficult. And so to be able to sit down and do it from your home versus trying to figure out 10 friends who are going to actually get a hold of the physical money to deliver to a candidate, I think is a very different process. So I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say that it's just as easy to use cash as it is to use Bitcoin to get around campaign finance laws.
That's Representative Jimmy Anderson, Democrat from Fitchburg. Also with us, Phil Anderson, chairman of Wisconsin's Libertarian Party, candidate for governor. We're talking about the idea of using cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and the other stuff out there for campaign donations. Phil, you're hoping, obviously, that the Ethics Commission gives the green light for these donations. Also, part of what you're looking for is just clarity one way or another. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, right now, as I mentioned, the federal government has rules in place that candidates have used and include donations of cryptocurrency in their definition of intangible and tangible assets. To my knowledge, there's been no report of abuse or lack of accountability in terms of those donations. And as I mentioned as well, the previous set of rules adopted by the Wisconsin State Assembly included intangible and tangible assets in their definition. As a matter of fact, one of the things that the Ethics Commission ran into is that there's still some language in terms of how to process donations that includes tangible and intangible in it. So the current set of rules aren't even consistent with themselves in terms of those definitions. So we're talking about cryptocurrencies. The larger issue is freedom of speech and people able to support candidates in whatever way they choose, and being incumbent on the candidates to do the proper documentation and to obey the campaign finance rules.
And Representative Anderson, are you hoping, do you agree that whatever the ruling is, there is a need for clarity, that one way or another, gray areas need to be cleared up here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We need to make sure that we understand if cryptocurrency is going to be used, how it's going to be processed, if it's going to be treated the same way like we take cash donations. I think that it's dangerous to kind of just leave it up to each individual candidate trying to figure out how to handle this, and so I really do hope that they clarify the law.
Now, Phil, the Wisconsin State Journal talked to a corporate finance and investment banking expert at UW-Madison. He said, hey, here's a solution. Why not say if you want to use your Bitcoin money, cash in the Bitcoin money, pay it, donate regular money right after you cash that in. Would that be a workaround?
Well, it would be a workaround, but it's not consistent with the idea that people can contribute tangible assets now. So if the concern was wanting everything to come in liquid currency form, then the state could certainly require people to liquidate real estate or cars or boats or gold or silver or whatever to cash before they turn it in. So I don't think it's reasonable that there be that additional step required. And further, I just mentioned one particular online portal, BitPay, automatically converts it to cash. So as long as, and even if the commission said that as a stipulation that it needed to be converted immediately to remove any issue of people sitting on Bitcoin and appreciating or depreciating in value before it's actually turned into cash, it can be solved through current technology that immediately converts it to cash at the market value. So before, me as a candidate, my campaign committee and my treasurer never touch Bitcoin. They're able to make a contribution through the portal, and then it just hits our bank account with a cash amount and then is reportable from there.
And Representative Anderson, what about this idea that this is free speech? If I'm able to donate in cash or check or other durable goods, whatever, this is maybe the wave of the future, these cryptocurrencies. Why can't that be part of my options here?
Sure. I think that the problem ends up, again, coming back down to anonymity. It's going to be a balancing test. I mean, there's always going to be limits to free speech, and the question is whether or not the concerns around anonymity, especially as Bitcoin becomes a more, and other cryptocurrencies become a more popular way for people to spend money on the internet, whether the anonymity fears and concerns when it comes to campaign finance outweighs the need for or the interest in people to use cryptocurrency to donate to campaigns. Ultimately, for me, again, understanding the technology as I do, I just think that the concerns around how our campaign finance laws can be ignored or worked around, especially at the state level, it's too big of a concern for me. And I think that, again, if people want to use Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrencies, just like you said, they should be able to convert it into cash and then use that to write a check or make a standard donation.
Thanks to both of our guests for joining us. Phil Anderson is chairman of the Libertarian Party of Wisconsin and a candidate for governor. Jimmy Anderson is a Democratic state representative from Fitchburg. They're with us to talk about the possible use of cryptocurrency, these things like Bitcoin that you're seeing in the news, in campaign giving and spending in state elections, state campaigns. Michael Jackson's 1982 album Thriller is the top-selling album of all time with about 66 million copies sold, more depending on who you ask. Don't expect that record to fall or even be threatened anytime soon. It's got a big lead over the next top seller, the Eagles' Greatest Hits. Plus, if our next guest is right, the album's heyday is over. Figures from the Recording Industry Association of America show that in 1999, nearly 940 million CDs were sold. That's just CDs. Last year, according to Nielsen Music, only about 170 million albums were sold. That includes the CDs and digital albums and vinyl and cassettes. So why aren't people buying albums anymore? Might they ever make a comeback? Bobby Osinski is a music industry veteran, having worked as a producer, engineer, and musician. He's the author of 24 books and a contributor to Forbes. We're talking about his recent piece now titled The Music Album is Dead, But Not Everyone's Accepted It Yet. Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Good to hear Thriller again.
It's been a while for me, too. Now, why is the album dead, more or less, not just a hurting or on life support?
Well, people are not consuming multiple songs from the same artist like they used to. It used to be something that everyone would do. They'd sit down with their vinyl record or CD, and they would pay attention for a long period of time to that one artist, to that one particular piece of plastic. And not any longer. We now live in a streaming society. It's a singles society. And I don't know that it's better or worse, but it certainly is different.
When I read your piece, I thought, oh, this is kind of a bummer. All those other people, not me, I've stopped listening to albums. Then I thought about my own listening habits, and I go online, I listen to the song I want, or I stream a randomly selected group of songs along the lines of things I like. It's pretty rare that I go and intentionally listen to an album, except maybe a CD in the car. What has changed? Has the streaming changed us, or is there something about our attention spans that have changed?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both. And of course, the music industry evolves and changes, and it changes especially with technology. And this goes all the way back to, we can trace it from sheet music onward. Every time there's a new piece of technology, the music industry is pretty much on the forefront of accepting it and incorporating it. And then that changes consumer patterns as well. So now with streaming, we're just in the latest iteration of that. That being said, I don't know that it's that different than radio, which we've been consuming for, what, 100 years now. And, of course, it's always been, except for a brief period, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, in the whole realm of FM, for the most part, it's been a singles distribution medium.
You say that the music industry adjusts, but have artists, music producers really adjusted? Are people still tilting at the windmill and trying to produce that album and get people to buy it?
Well, I hate to say that, yes, that's the case. I think if you're a younger artist, and especially it seems like in the R&B hip-hop community, they're much hipper to this because they've been used to doing things a little bit differently and being rebellious for quite a while now. But when it comes to most artists, they still see the CD as kind of like the Holy Grail. And that being said, there's not too much of a reason to create a CD these days. And there's lots of reasons not to. And it would be to the benefit of the artist not to do so in many ways. I mean, one being the fact that when you create a CD or an album, let's just say an album because it can be distributed lots of different ways. What ends up happening is you have one piece of product and one event to promote it. When you take 10 individual songs and you release them once a month, once every 6 weeks, once every 2 months, then you have 10 separate events to, first of all, acclimate the public to 10 different songs. And you and I know that what ends up happening when you buy an album, you gravitate to one or two songs, and you listen to those most of the time. And then the other ones aren't exposed at all. And especially, a lot of times you'll buy an album, you'll listen to it once through and pick that one song and always go back to it. But now, when you have multiple releases, there's, again, more promotional events, but there's also more of a chance for the song to be exposed to a greater number of people.
Talking to Bobby Osinski, music industry veteran, about the death maybe of the album. You know, a group of songs released all at the same time in a particular order, whether that's on CD or vinyl or digital download. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still listen to an album maybe from beginning to end? Do you buy music in album-sized chunks? Again, whether it's in a physical medium or downloading. 800-642-1234 is the number to call in. And Bobby, you wrote that some people, as you were just talking about, have moved to that model of forget the album, we're going to release a single now and maybe in a couple months or a few weeks, whatever. And maybe that's not so new because that's how things used to be a long time ago, 60 years ago or so, in the music industry.
Yeah, in the 50s and 60s and even into the early 70s, if you didn't sell enough singles, then you never got a chance as an artist to make the album. Everything was based around the success of not one single, unless it was a runaway huge hit, but a couple. And that would prove that you were worthwhile as an artist, or your music was worthwhile, or there's an audience out there for what you're doing in order to take that next step to create the album. And now, well, let's say in the 70s, that all changed, mostly because the music industry made a whole lot more money on albums. And when it seemed like that was taking off and it was becoming a more acceptable format, then I think the music industry looked more at it from a revenue model than they did from a creative model. So everything changed. And now we're kind of going back, much to the chagrin of the music industry, because certainly it would much prefer to sell albums, again, bigger chunk. But, you know, we've not been there for quite a while now.
As a music person, do we lose something? Is there something unique about the creative form that is the album, a series of songs, maybe whether they're on a theme or not, but they're put in that order, a lot of thought gets put into it. Do we lose something if we lose the album?
Well, yes and no. I have to say that I just finished producing an album not that long ago, producing and mixing it. And when it was finished, there was a lot of thought that went into the song order of the album. Now again, it sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here. But what I did was I strongly urged the band not to do an album. Strongly. And they said, well, our fans insist on an album. And that may be true because they had core fans that actually wanted it. So, okay, there's an exception to everything. But that being said, getting back to your question, there was a lot of brain cells that died over the sequence of the album. And this has always been the case to some degree. Songs are chosen strategically. And the reason why is, of course, you want to maintain as much interest as possible. So you try to make sure that no two songs up against one another are the same tempo or in the same key, or there's just enough of a change that will keep the listener interest. Now, that certainly worked back in the day of the album when everybody was listening to them, but it's so much less relevant these days that it's hardly even worth talking about. That being said, the one place that does change is when the artist is actually creating a suite of songs that go together, a concept album, so to speak, where that's really important. And of course, I can see the value of it in that situation. That being the case, it so rarely happens when there is a suite of songs that go together and intelligently go together. You know, it's one thing to have a whole bunch of songs and put them back to back and try to make them say something, try to make them into a story. And a lot of people try to do that and it doesn't really work. But if they're written as a group, as a whole, as a concept, that's a little bit different, but it so rarely happens.
We're talking to Bobby Osinski, talking about his recent piece in Forbes. The music album is dead, but not everyone's accepted it yet. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy listening to albums from start to finish? Do you still do that? Is it something you used to do but faded away from? How do you experience music? Shuffled online, downloaded? Do you download individual songs? Do you still buy a physical medium, a CD, an album? Do you listen to the whole thing? If you do, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon is often ranked as one of the greatest music albums of all time. Bassist and vocalist Roger Waters told Rolling Stone in 2011 that this is the band's first album that was, quote, genuinely thematic and genuinely about something. And it's that kind of hour-long or so cohesive message that our guest says people maybe don't have the patience to endure in one sitting. That's not how they listen anymore. Albums may be going away. Bobby Osinski, a music industry veteran, is with us, author of 24 books, contributor to Forbes, and you can join it at 800-642-1234. Is the album dead to you, or do you still listen to music, albums from beginning to end? And how do you do it? Do you stream it, download it, buy the CD, the album, the 8-track? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Richard is with us in Madison. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so back in 2005, I had an iPod, and a friend swore that he would never get an iPod because of something he called, like, musical ADD. And that sort of stuck with me. He gave me the Flaming Lips album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, and ever since then, I've always tried to listen to the entire album, and now I do it with Spotify, with YouTube, and since then, I've recently started going to CD stores and actually buying used CDs because it costs half as much as you can get them even through Amazon.
Richard, do you ever feel like it's a chore to get through maybe the two or three songs of an album you're not as into?
Well, I'm never looking for hits. You know, I'm actually trying to discover whether or not I like the artist. And I have been disappointed before, but generally I get a kick out of knowing that I'm going to try to absorb this whole album, that I'm supporting local businesses by buying used CDs.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. I'm sure Richard's not alone, Bobby, but he's not the norm either, it sounds like.
Well, all I can say is good for you, Richard. That's, as you say, Rob, not the norm any longer. There's a shorter attention span for sure. I mean, one of the things that actually talks about attention span, when you look at the, or speaks to the attention span of listening to music, if you look at the stats, you find that songs today are much shorter than they've ever been. And, you know, of course, when we talk about singles, they've always been in the 3 minute, 3.5, maybe even pushing 4 minute range. And now we're down to just about 3 minutes and even less in many cases. So it just goes to show that our attention span has changed. And that's probably because of the digital world that we live in today. Again, not better or worse. It's just different.
Thanks a lot for the call, Richard. We'll go next to Paul in Menominee Falls. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Great program. I grew up in the 70s, so you're more of a creature of habit, and I probably have a hybrid kind of use of the albums. I, like most people, there's songs I like and songs I don't. But I do find, and I still listen to CDs, I like albums. I think they're convenient for my taste. But I do like the fact that I'm exposed to songs that normally I would not be. So if I'm just, like your previous caller said, chasing a hit, you know, if I buy an album for that, then, you know, I'm going to hear other songs that I normally don't hear. So, you know, for me, for my taste, and I understand why people are, you know, obviously it's going to change. It's not going to stay the same. But I do like that aspect. So, great program.
Paul, thanks a lot for that. Thanks a lot for your call. And, Bobby, that reminds me, there are some songs that are kind of the slow burn on an album, right? You might get the album, come in for the hit or two, and as you listen, you appreciate those other songs maybe even more. But in a world of just singles, are those slow burn songs that grow on you going to see the light of day?
Yeah, I was just going to go there, Rob. That's one of the downsides of being in a singles world, because we all know that a record label will pick the hits, pick the songs that they believe will be the hit, and then they'll concentrate on promoting them. And there's been so many cases over the years where they've been wrong, and there has been something that everyone thought was a throwaway song that becomes the big hit. But you don't know unless you're exposed to it, unless people are exposed to it and could hear those things. So that's the downside. There may be lots of music that the masses would fall in love with, but they'll never hear it. At least the way things are going today, they're not going to hear it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Paul. We are talking about the past and maybe limited future of the album, the whole collection of songs that you listen to from beginning to end. Bobby Osinski with us. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences at 800-642-1234 to John now in Elkhorn. John, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, here I am. I grew up listening to music in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and I always listened to the whole album. I could tell you all the songs on the album and where they went. But I can imagine one of the reasons why we've gone away from this. It's become very convenient, depending on how you source your music, to go from song to song. Back in the day, I could tell you, 10th Avenue Freeze Out was the second song on this particular album. And you know what? To get to that song, you had to be able to drop the needle in that groove. And, you know, sometimes it was like, I'm a little bit too high. I'm not going to do that right now. But today, boom, you just go to the second song.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, John, thanks a lot. And a similar thing with cassettes. You want to listen to track two, you're probably best off listening to track one instead of fast-forwarding to just the right spot. Just the technology kind of determines this, Bobby.
Well, there you go. That's the adaptation of new technology by the industry and the consumer. Consumer doesn't care about the quality, never has, but cares about the convenience. So if we look at all of the distribution formats, they all move forward in terms of technology. So your example there, cassettes, you had to rewind or fast forward to get to where you wanted. And then it was the same thing with the LP. You had to actually lift the needle the tone arm and find the right track. And then we get to the CD where it's random access, where you just say, I want track 11, and you go directly to track 11. And now we're in streaming, and it's even more convenient to actually select what we want or select a playlist or whatever it might be. So we're in a consumer world where convenience triumphs all the time. And that's one of the things that people sort of forget about in the industry. They'll focus on other things, thinking the consumer is going to go that way, but they never have. They've always looked for convenience first.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to talk about another possible upside here, Bobby. We've interviewed musicians from around Wisconsin on this show a lot. These are people who really hustle. They try to get the word out, and it's less resource intensive. There may be fewer gatekeepers. If they had to do a whole album, that might be tough to overcome. If they can just throw out singles here and there, you know, throwing spaghetti against the wall, it's easier for them to have a shot at getting that one song out than if they had to do this whole big project.
Yeah, you know, I just ran into that the other day where I had an artist wanting to email me the files for his album. And my response was, what decade are you living in? Because no one does that anymore. We all respond, especially if you're in the business, you want to get to things fast. And this is labels, managers, agents, anybody in the business, reviewers. So therefore, they want to stream and they want to be able to hit it fast. And they want, okay, tell me your top two or three songs. Let's get to it. Rather than me having to find my way through an album to figure out whether I like it and actually figuring out a way I should download it, if there's a CD that's sent to me, finding a player. I don't even own anything that will play a shiny plastic disc anymore. So there you go. It's a different world in how we look at it. But again, it's more efficient in many ways. So it's not a bad thing either.
Let's take one more caller. Liz is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Liz, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Liz?
I am a member of a classical contemporary vocal quartet, and we've recorded a couple albums now. And every time we kind of mount the giant process of doing that with our, you know, a boutique label that we work with, that's the big question is, do we release an album? Do we make an EP? Do we just make a bunch of downloads that are available? Because there are so many options. And I liked the point you made earlier about the sort of shorter attention span and the 3-minute sort of single. In classical music or even contemporary classical music, that's not always the case. I mean, one of our next projects is an hour-long concert piece that is broken into smaller movements, but some of them make no sense unless they're in the context of this larger piece. So we kind of wonder, like, how do we present this to an audience? How do we do this?
And Liz, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. Bobby, we don't need to dig into contemporary classical too much, but in general, it sounds like your advice to a musician, an artist, would be do the singles, not the whole album right now.
Yeah, it would be that, but again, it depends on your audience as well. If you do have an audience that expects longer pieces and expects an album, then that would be the way to go. Obviously, there are always exceptions.
Liz, thanks a lot for calling in. Bobby, I got to ask briefly as we wrap up, is there an album you still go back to and listen to from beginning to end?
No.
No, not at all.
I wish I could say yes, but no.
I wish I could too. I think I can't. Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Bobby Osinski, music industry veteran. He's worked as a producer, an engineer, and a musician. He's the author of 24 books. We've been talking to him about a recent piece he wrote. It's called The Music Album is Dead, But Not Everyone's Accepted It Yet. You can still weigh in with your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's spring, and it feels like spring, and in Wisconsin, that means a lot of us are eating even more ice cream and custard than we were already eating through the winter. If you're like me, you may sometimes base life decisions on what the flavor of the day is. Culver's, the chain, just dropped a list of 6 new flavors they're rolling out over the next bunch of months. including things like cappuccino, cookie crumble, blackberry cobbler, chocolate pretzel crunch, and more. Producer Natalie Guyette is in here. You've watched for Flavor of the Day at another chain.
Yeah, I used to live in Milwaukee, so everybody in Milwaukee either likes Cops or Leon's. There's a few other chains that are pretty good, too, but there's usually a hardcore side, one or the other, and people like to argue over that.
Was there a flavor that's like, oh, if that's on the board, I'm going in for you?
One really popular flavor is the tiramisu, which I actually think is one of their flavors today. So if you're in Milwaukee, you might want to check it out.
And I know my wife's family's in the Milwaukee area, and at family gatherings, there would be, they'd be, oh, well, this Cop's had butter pecan, this one had, they would like scout for each other. And if it was a particular flavor and you're going to see a particular person, you better stop and get that pint, not just a, you know, a cone. Do you ever buy it by the pint at the custard shops?
I'm more of like the first two bites are the best bites anyway, so I'm okay with just a small dish, but that's me.
I'm a waffle cone kind of person, so I like lots of bites of the custard or ice cream. I'm not, I don't take one side or the other on that.
That's great. Are you more of a chocolate or a fruit?
Chocolate, all the way. Yeah, chocolate with lots of chunks of stuff in it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.